pulls Octavia forward. "Then I condemn these failings as being no good," she says. "Not of God." Emily walks round to face me and rests her Bible on top of my head. "I command in the name of Jesus that this daughter be delivered from the control of evil spirits." The knife in her other hand is pressing into the skin of my neck. My eyes roll back in my head. "I am free," I whisper. "I can feel them leaving my body." Then I look at her and say, "They can't hurt me anymore." And my body goes limp in the chair. The Secret. I am delivered, healed, restored. The fact the devil chose to infect me with such abominable thoughts and deeds has elevated me in Octavia's estimation. She thought I was beneath his notice. She didn't think I had it in me. "The Lord forgives you," she said when it was all over. "And so do I." Then she put her arms around me. I think I was expected to hold on to her, or cry, or both. But it is too late for that. 20 years too late. "No one else need ever know what you have confessed," she said, and then she looked at Emily, who answered with a nod. "My poor daughter, to think of the torment you have suffered. If only we could cleanse your mind of the memories of all those unnatural acts. Well, you mustn't think about it. About her." But of course she is all I want to think about. Grace, and where she might be, and how I will find her. "And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." Now the demons are gone, I am calm. That's what I told Octavia, that I feel lighter, that my mind is quiet, that I can feel God's love once more. I said the whole experience had made me ravenous, which is just what she wanted to hear. And she put forward her theory that with all those spirits inside me, my stomach had been restricted. Apparently evil can suppress even your appetite. Betty set out a light lunch in the dining room. "It is such a relief to be out of my bedroom," I said. "I feel like I have been freed." Emily advised caution, warning that the demons could have left some traces of mischief in me. "No, I have complete confidence in the power of the Divine Mother," I said. "I felt them leave, Emily. It was wonderful." Octavia is quite convinced that there is no need to keep my bedroom door locked from now on. She can see that I am quite recovered. I ate 2 egg sandwiches and a small piece of lemon drizzle. But I can't leave the garden. Not yet. Not while the devil is still at large. Fortified with tea and cake, Octavia and Emily went to the chapel, where they have a busy afternoon of exorcism planned. Every member has been given a time to present themselves and make their confession, and after 30 minutes each one will emerge a different woman. After such a harrowing morning, Octavia insisted that I must get some rest. I agreed, of course, but I had no intention of going to sleep. From my bedroom window I watched them cross the lawn and disappear into the chapel, and when I was sure they were gone, I went back along the landing to Emily's door to find the letters she has been hiding. The letters from Adrian. I turned the handle softly, but it would not move. I pushed my weight against it. I slammed my fist until the door shook in the frame. But she had locked it. And that is why I have to do this now. That's why I'm standing here shivering in my nightdress. My hand is on the doorknob again. But this time Emily is behind the door. I can hear her sleeping. It must be after midnight. Octavia was first to bed, just after the chapel clock chimed 9. Then I heard nothing until Emily climbed the stairs and Peter his ladder to the attic. I sat on my chair and listened to Betty moving in the kitchen below my bedroom, tidying pans, washing teacups, then rattling the front door to check it was locked. She walked across the landing to Grace's room. I suppose it is her room again now. Then I waited. I waited for everything to fall silent, but the restless house would not quieten. Floorboards creaked to get comfortable. Water murmured in the pipes. Walls and windows settled into a fitful sleep. If anyone finds me now, I can still pretend I have got up to use the lavatory. But once I go into Emily's room, I will be out of bounds. If I'm discovered, they will know I am up to something. The doorknob does its best to betray me with a click of its catch. I stop and wait to check I haven't woken her. I can hear her heavy breaths, louder now the door is ajar. It is the first time I have stepped into this room since it became hers. When I was a child, it was my parents' room. Mother would allow us to come in so she could tell us all a story. Then Nanny would scoop us up and tuck us into our own beds. Emily looks like one of the hags from the fairy tales we read, before Octavia decided that Hans Christian Andersen was ungodly and every knight was Matthew, Mark, Luke or John. Emily is lying on her back, eyes closed, mouth slightly open. In the lamplight, she looks so small, you could almost imagine she was harmless. Powerless. And right now, she is. I could do the things I told them I had been thinking of. I could wrap my fingers around her throat. I could take a pillow and smother her, hold it over her face while she twitched and twisted, press it down until she lay still. The taste of cotton would be the last she'd ever know. Cotton. Grace's nightdress. But I mustn't think of her. Not now. I need to find Adrian's letters. Emily isn't moving. The sight of her makes me think of something else. Of Ellen lying still and stiff in her bed. For a moment I am breathing in her memory, the acetous scent of decaying flowers and stale silence. But I am not imagining things. I never was. It is Emily's perfume I can smell. There's a bottle of lavender water on her bedside table, and beside it is the Jerusalem knife and a small bunch of keys, which I pick up and hold tightly to muffle the jingle of metal. One of them must fit her bureau. The first is too big, but the second unlocks the top drawer. There's nothing inside it but writing pads and headed notepaper. I try the next drawer down. It sticks at first, but I open it enough to slip my fingers inside, pushing down a pile of papers that are jammed behind the lip. There are newspaper cuttings, headlines about earthquakes and storms, and among them is a letter in Adrian's handwriting. I fold it twice and hide it in the palm of my hand. And just then, I hear Emily stir. She rolls over to face me. She stretches out, but her eyes are still closed. There must be more letters, but I don't make a sound now. Betty, she murmurs, rolling onto her other side. She is going to wake up. She's going to find me here. I stand and wait for her breathing to sink back into its steady pattern. And when she falls still, I slide the drawer back gently and make my way round to the door, returning the keys to the bedside table. The Jerusalem knife is gone. Dillis, she says, what are you doing in here? Her eyes are shining in the darkness. Her voice is on the edge of breaking. She is frightened. Of me. And for a moment I cannot help smiling. You don't need to be frightened, Emily. I am only sleepwalking. I lift the lamp and she cries out, covering her face with her arm to protect herself. And I stand perfectly still, shining the light on a pair of invisible eyes on the wall. My voice is slow and flat. Ellen, I say, is that you? Have you come back? Do you know where Grace is? Without looking at her, I turn and walk out of the room. I want to run, but I take each step slowly. Back into my bedroom. Back into my bed. And I take Adrian's letter, which is screwed up in my fist, and I hide it under my pillow until I can be sure that she won't follow me. Only then do I open it. Edward Reeves, Esquire, Jessop and Son, 5C Harper Street, Bedford. Dear Mrs. Baltrop, I have been instructed by my client, Mr. Adrian Baltrop, to record his concerns about the health of his sister Dillis, who he has come to understand is suffering with nerve problems. He has written to you on this subject on a number of occasions, but having received no reply, has come to the conclusion that you are either choosing to ignore his letters or have been prevented from reading them by some third party. He strongly suspects that you are being given false counsel by those closest to you, and urges you to put the needs of your daughter ahead of the religious mania which he feels has divided his family and taken over his family home. Furthermore, he has come to understand that a gentleman, Mr. Peter Rasmussen, is living with you in 12 Albany Road. It is his belief that this is wholly improper, and in light of stories of immoral practices between you, asks you to put a stop to this arrangement with immediate effect. A copy of this letter has been kept on file as proof that it was sent. Failure to reply will result in Mr. Baltrop taking legal action against those who are obstructing his sister's access to treatment. Yours sincerely, Edward Reeves, Esquire.
Deliverance. I am smiling. It is the thought of Emily's face last night, the image of her cowering in bed. She who is the holder of secrets, the one who calls all others to make their confessions. Now I have the knowledge. I am the one who knows what she has been hiding. I have the truth she has locked away in the drawers of her bureau. I am going to get away from here. From her. From all of this. It is not too late. I sit at my desk and write to Adrian. I tell him that I'm going to get out, that I will find a way. Send help at 6:15 p.m. on Saturday when they are all at chapel. Come and help me. Further than 77 steps away, far enough that Octavia can't follow. I write all this, take a stamp from the box of letters in my wardrobe and put the envelope in my pocket. If I can get to Castleside, I will be able to sneak out and post it. So I will take breakfast downstairs with them this morning. I will prove that I am well and that they don't need to worry. I will get dressed and style my hair and present myself at the table. I will eat and smile and chat. I will ask them how they got on with Kate Firth's casting out yesterday and how many demons they chased out of her body. I will pretend that nothing happened last night. Emily won't say anything. Not in front of Octavia. But when I take my place at the breakfast table, there is hardly a word spoken by anyone. It is toast this morning, so everyone is concentrating on eating quietly. I can tell Octavia is trying to ignore the scraping, the crunching, the swallowing, and by the time we have finished, she is struggling to sit still. "I am going to my room," she says, flinching at the sound of Betty collecting up the plates. "Before you do," I say, "I can't find my keys for Castleside. Do you have them? I plan to get back to work there today." I'm trying to sound as if it is an afterthought. Unimportant. Peter stirs his tea and knocks the edge of his saucer with the teaspoon as he lays it back down. Octavia jumps out of her chair. "You'll have to talk to Emily about it," she says. "I really must get to my room." She is already halfway out of the door. Emily is waiting for me to ask her, but I won't. There is silence between us, a silence uncomfortable enough to make Peter stand up, make his excuses and go. "I have your keys, Dillis," Emily says. "We thought it best that I keep hold of them while you were acting so erratically, for your own safety. I'm not sure where I put them, but the back door is unlocked anyway, and you have no need to open the front now the work has finished. Unless you are planning to go somewhere." I need access to the opening room. There are a number of details I need to see to, some pictures to hang. "Everything has been taken care of," says Emily. "Octavia asked me to take over while you were resting. Best that I keep hold of the keys." "I'll speak to Octavia about it," I say, "when she is feeling better." "Yes, do, and so will I. I'm sure Octavia will ask the Divine Mother for guidance on the matter. It is obvious to me that you are still not well, Dillis. She pauses as if deciding whether to say more. After last night... Last night? You were out of bed. I think you are mistaken, Emily. I slept very soundly. Perhaps it was you that was dreaming. Perhaps the burden of God's expectation is getting too heavy for you to bear. She thinks she has one, but Kate said there was another set of keys in the drawers of the desk in Castleside. She told me so the day she first showed me around. The back door is open and everything is just as I left it. I'm greeted by the smell of new paint that became so familiar in the weeks I spent here, when Grace used to bring my lunch and sit beside me. This is my place. I am the only one who knows about the scratched drawing in the cupboard, the dents on the doorframe and the damp that is creeping up behind the skirting board in the corner of the front bedroom. I know every imperfection and every scar. I know the frayed cord on the sash window where I used to sit and watch for Grace coming up the path, the loose doorknob I turned to rush out the front door, the cracked tile in the hallway where I would stand and count to eight, then eight again, before I let her in. We'd sit in the kitchen on two dining room chairs and talk about the others while we ate lunch. Sometimes I'd bring a stool and insist she put her feet up. She'd close her eyes and I'd roll up her sleeve and stroke her forearm until the tiny hairs on her skin rose up to meet my touch. If I close my eyes, I can imagine her scent on my skin. If I bring my fingers to my lips, I imagine I can almost taste her. She is written between the lines of my fingerprints, like the powder that's left behind when you touch a butterfly's wing. When I get away from here, I'll find you, Grace. I'll take your hand. We'll walk beside the river and we'll laugh again. It's not too late, Grace. Not for us. But my desk is gone. Emily has moved me out. She has found the keys. I run to the front door and try the handle, but it's locked. Of course it's locked. I rest my head against the stained glass and think about the letter in my pocket. And then I start to see shapes moving, turning the vivid colours of the glass dull. There are footsteps on the gravel outside and the sound of the letterbox being lifted. An envelope drops through it and lands by my feet. Wait, I say, kneeling down to shout through the letterbox. Excuse me, I'm sorry about this. Half a face appears in the opening, just a pair of eyes. I'm afraid I've mislaid my keys, I say. Could I trouble you to put this in the postbox when you pass it, please? It's urgent. The eyes smile in at me. Of course, miss. I need to keep my voice steady. I mustn't give myself away. Thank you. Rather strange to be posting a letter out to you. It's usually the other way around. But it really is vital that it is delivered. Do you live here now, then? He says. It used to be the old schoolhouse, didn't it? I've seen you've been busy getting the place sorted out. Yes, we are hoping to open up for some guests very soon. I live at 12 Albany Road. Do you have any post for me? Dillis Baltrop. Or my mother Octavia. Mabel. I can take it now if you like. He stands up and I see a pile of letters being shuffled in his hands. One for Mrs. Baltrop, he says. And I have to stop myself from snatching it when he pushes it through the door. Thank you. You'll definitely post the one I gave you. It's important. I will, miss. Good luck finding those keys. I let the letterbox fall shut and rest my forehead on it, listening to the footsteps moving away across the gravel. Only when I am sure he is gone do I sit back on my heels and tear the letter open. Edward Reeves, Esquire. Jessop and Son, 5C Harper Street, Bedford. Dear Mrs. Baltrop, I write to you again on behalf of my client, Mr. Adrian Baltrop, on a matter of great urgency. Since we have received no reply from you and no assurances about the well-being of Miss Dillis Baltrop, your son has determined to return to England himself. His ship left India 2 weeks ago and he is expected in Bedford any day. He wishes to warn you that, though you appear to show no pity for his sister's suffering, there are those who are prepared to assist him in getting her the treatment she so desperately needs. With the help of a concerned party, Mr. Baltrop managed to get a doctor to diagnose Miss Baltrop. His orders were that she must be taken away from Bedford to a specialist hospital immediately, and that any delay could have grave consequences. With the opinion of an expert in this field, you can no longer afford to ignore Mr. Baltrop's fears. Any refusal on your part to allow access to the patient will be considered a criminal offence and action will be taken accordingly. Yours sincerely, Edward Reeves, Esquire. All this time I feared I was going mad. I thought my mother's secret had become my own, but it's the very thing that will set me free. What if there was a way? Grace said. Would you take it? Do you trust me? Adrian sent a doctor to me, with the help of a concerned party. Grace was the one who brought him to me on Ellen's deathbed. She is probably sitting with Adrian right now, planning how to get me away from here. This is the only way he could get to me, to force Octavia to let me go. Now all I have to do is sit and wait, and behave myself. Bide my time until Saturday. Sit quietly in chapel. Bow my head in silent contemplation. Sit and watch Emily attack demons with the Jerusalem knife. Drink the water, praise the Lord, chew quietly. Be invisible. Colourless, faultless, zero. Just as I've been taught. 77 Steps. Time has slowed, and I wonder if they are coming for me at all. My letter to Adrian might still be in the postman's pocket. I see him standing by the postbox, the wind picking up and snatching it from his hand, flinging it into the river. I see it lying on the surface, soaking up the water, my blue handwriting starting to bleed into the paper, then disappearing into grey. But I must stop thinking the worst. I pace around the outside of the garden and listen for Grace, hoping she will call from the other side of the wall. She is with me when I sit on the bench by the tree, when I climb the ladder into the clock tower, when I watch the washing dancing on the line. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. I know they are all watching from their windows, but they can't see Grace. Only I can see her, in my memory. Only I can hear her whisper, "It won't be long now." But I am frightened I will give myself away, that I won't be able to keep the truth inside. It shouts for me to let it out. When Emily looks at me over breakfast, it is all I can do to stop myself from slamming her head into the table, from screaming at Octavia, "Look at her! Look what she has done!" To Grace, to Ellen, to us. It is all I can do to stop myself telling her about Adrian, but I can't let them know what I am planning. Besides, I know she wouldn't believe me. She listens only to the Divine Mother now. I think it is a relief to pass the burden to someone else. Any question, any problem, and Emily takes out her Bible and her knife. She closes her eyes and gives Octavia the answer she wants to hear, and sometimes the one she doesn't. Since that telegram arrived from America, she doesn't have to worry about saying the wrong thing. It is all the truth. "You are very quiet, Dillis," she says. "Yes, Emily, I am choosing not to speak. I might say too much, and then Octavia will lock me in my room again." "Just tired," I say.
"Of you?"
"I sleep as much as I can. When I have typed up the latest directive or delivered another article to the printing room, I lie on my bed and think of Grace. It passes another minute, another hour, another day. Every second spent is a second closer to escape. In my daydream, she is waiting for me across the street. I walk out of the house and pull the door shut behind me and she smiles. But when I fall into a fitful sleep, she always turns away. I step into the road to follow her and I don't see the car coming towards me. I only hear the crack of my bones as I am thrown over the bonnet. You can walk with me to chapel, Dillis, Emily says. It is 6 o'clock. We had better go. We mustn't keep Octavia waiting.
Go without me, I say. I am not feeling well. I'll follow on.
I'm sorry to hear that, she says, but she is not sorry. Not really. Octavia was suffering earlier too.
As she walks out of my bedroom, I realize it is the last time I will see her. This is the end for us. But she has no idea.
Emily? What is it?
She turns back, agitated that I am making her late.
I'll be down shortly.
I mustn't say all the things I want to. But I stand and think them as I listen to her leaving. 13 steps along the landing, 11 down the stairs. From my window, I watch the others heading into chapel. They look so ordinary, so benign. Up here I will get everything ready. Octavia does not tolerate tardiness, and I'm not sure why it matters to me now, but I want to leave everything just as it should be. The 3 wise monkeys watching on as I make my bed and arrange my books. I am not taking anything with me, except my fur coat and the Bible she gave me on my 8th birthday. I'm hoping I'll find God in there, the God I knew when I was young. In my pocket I have a blue button and the notes Grace left under my pillow. I kept them all. I can't bear the thought of Emily finding them after I've gone, but neither can I bear to throw them away. The chapel clock is chiming 6. I go to Grace's room to look down at the street. I haven't been back in here since the day Emily sat on that bed and told me her lies. I haven't been back in here since then because it is Betty who sleeps in here now. Because Grace has gone. And soon I will be too. There is no sign of Adrian outside, but he will come. I know he will. It is time. Time to walk along the landing. Time to walk past Octavia's bedroom door. Time to whisper goodbye in my head. There is no point in saying it out loud. She is in the chapel now, healing the sick and delivering the sinful from the devil. And it wouldn't matter what I said, she wouldn't listen. She never has. If I told her, she would find a way to stop me. Or get Emily to. She gets Emily to do all the difficult jobs now. That way she can concentrate on being worshipped. At the bottom of the stairs, I check the front door, just in case, but of course it is locked. I'll have to climb out of the window in the sitting room, go through the net curtain that separates in here from out there. There will be no witnesses to my passing. It is gone 6, everyone is at chapel now. Even Sir Jack is asleep, perched on the edge of the sideboard, his eyes closed. I pull Octavia's wicker chair to the window and lift the catch that holds the casement down. The frame rumbles in the grooves either side, but opens no more than a few inches before it sticks, wood against wood, screeching in pain. I bow my head and I am praying, praying for a miracle. And with my eyes still shut, I reach up and try to move the window again. Please, God, let it open. Suddenly I feel someone shove me from behind, a knock on the back of my head which sends me falling forward into the glass pane. I turn and see a flash of black. I feel the flick of fingers against my skin. I try to see, but my eyes are fighting to stay open, as if the air itself is slapping me across the face. There's someone pulling my hair. I reach forward to fight them, but there is only empty space. No chest or arms, no body. I bring my hands up to my face, and that's when I feel him. The scratch of claws and feathers. He jerks, kicking back into my head as he propels himself into flight. But he stumbles in the empty air, his talons snagging on the skin above my eye. I feel him tear free. I see the clump of feathers that his tail has left in my clenched fist. I watch him bounce from wall to wall, sending ornaments toppling and a vase crashing to the floor. He is coming at me again, a spiteful whisper, razor sharp as he cuts through the air with serrated wings. I lash out with my arms to beat him back from my face, but he fights back, cackling like a madwoman. I must cover my eyes. That beak could pierce them,
pluck them out, peck away at all the light and leave me lost. I fall back into the window and I hear it creep, a long crack crawling across the glass.
Dillis, what in the Lord's name?
Octavia is in the doorway.
What are you doing?
Sir Jack!
Sir Jack, that is quite enough!
He flies another clumsy lap of the room, then settles on the table, shaking his feathers with a guilty shrug.
Dillis?
I touch my hand to the skin above my eyebrow and realize it is wet.
Dillis, what is going on?
He attacked me. I say, your bird attacked me.
Emily's doing, I suppose.
Has she been training him like she has been training you?
Dillis, that's enough.
This isn't right, I say. You aren't supposed to be here. You're supposed to be in chapel.
I had a headache. I was a little late in sitting to receive the Lord's words this evening. What is going on?
I heard the commotion from upstairs. She looks at the chair and the window. Then she looks at me, wearing a fur coat in the sitting room.
Dillis, what are you doing?
I am leaving.
You can't leave,
she says calmly, as if the act of saying it makes it true.
But I am, Octavia. I need to get away from here. From her. From you.
She steps forward, and for a moment I think she's going to reach out and touch me. But she doesn't. She makes her way as far as the table and steadies herself on one of the chairs, arms shaking, eyes cast down.
Dillis, we are so close now. Once the bishops come.
They will never come, Mother. I watched the box being opened myself. There is silence. Then she stumbles back, knocking against the sideboard.
Don't you dare, she whispers. You will not speak like that. I forbid it.
But even as the words leave her lips, she already knows.
I won't do as I am told.
Not any more. I pick up a leather-bound Bible from her desk and hit the window, and from the big crack smaller shoots grow. I hit it again and the shattered pieces fall out onto the path outside.
Dillis, stop!
She shouts.
Oh, Emily, thank God, do something!
She has come. Of course she has. Emily is standing in the doorway now.
Octavia, are you all right? Has she hurt you? I said she was a danger.
No, I'm quite safe, but Dillis is... Emily interrupts.
When you weren't in chapel, I came back to check on you. What is she doing?
I'm leaving, I say.
Have you finally lost your mind?
She says, the hint of a smile in her words.
Be careful, Dillis, you can get locked away for behaving like this.
She turns to Octavia.
Isn't that right? Emily, please don't.
Octavia gasps. And I realize Emily knows her secret. She found out, I say.
Is that why you let her take over? She is not taking over,
Octavia says, her voice rising to a cry.
I told her myself. She could see how I suffered. We prayed together for the Lord to help me.
And he sent the Divine Mother.
Yes, Dillis.
I start to laugh.
Perhaps it is time for Emily to make her confession. To tell you the thing she has been keeping secret.
Adrian has come to England. He has been trying to see you, but she wouldn't let him. She has been hiding his letters from you.
Emily shakes her head, but colour is flooding her cheeks. This is ridiculous. She really has gone too far this time. Octavia?
But my mother says nothing. She doesn't make a sound. She is holding her breath, covering her mouth with her hand.
And what else is she keeping from you?
I ask her.
I've been wondering about Edgar, about why she went to see him every day, so concerned for the health of a man who had sinned against you. Do you really think it was your healing she was putting in his water? Convenient that her prophecy... So now I am a murderess!
Emily shouts before I can say any more.
This is lunacy. She needs to be locked up.
No, Emily, that is not going to happen, I say. From here in the window I can see two figures, They have come for me. They are rushing up the path. Octavia and Emily have no idea. They jump when the knocking starts. It is time. I step on the wicker chair and make to climb out, but they rush forward. Dilly, the glass! Octavia grabs my coat and pulls me back. And when I look up, I see it, a shard sticking out of the frame. It would have cut my throat. Did she call me Dilly? The name she used when I was small. Come with me, Mother, I say. Adrian will look after us. He is taking me to India. You know I can't. Apollyon is waiting out there to devour me. Her breath is ragged. She is staring at the window as if demons might fly in through the broken pane. Oh, Lord, protect us. Emily rushes to the door. Betty, don't let them in, she shouts into the hallway. But it is too late. I hear footsteps, then two men come in. They are wearing white coats. Miss Dilys Baltrop, the first man asks me. You need to come with us. Otherwise, we have been instructed to call the police. At the end of the garden path, there is a black van waiting. I want to run to it, but I must concentrate on walking. One foot in front of the other. Head up, back straight, as if I'm wearing a corset. As if I have the faith and discipline to contain myself. I walk past the broken glass. The net curtains have snagged on the window frame, and the breeze has caught them, sucking them in and out as if the house is gasping for breath. My mother is standing behind them, looking out. Emily is by her side. She is leaving God's chosen land, she is saying. She is choosing to follow the devil's way. There is nothing you can do for her now. But I know the truth, Emily, and soon Mother will know too. I left two letters under her pillow after breakfast. Letters from Adrian. For nothing is secret that shall not be made manifest, neither anything hid that shall not be known and come abroad. Are you taking me all the way to India? I ask the two men as they open the doors at the back of the van. No, miss, one of them laughs, putting his hand on the top of my head as I stoop to climb in. Slowly now, we don't want you hurting yourself, do we? Dilys. From the darkness within I hear his voice, and my legs give way. He has come. I am safe. Adrian?
Dilys, I'm so sorry.
He reaches out and helps me onto a wooden bench that runs along the inside of the van.
I've been trying to get to you for so long.
The door slams shut and we are locked in together. It is dark, the only light cutting in through two vented windows in the back doors. It really is you, I say, bringing my face close to his. You have a moustache. I was expecting the little boy I used to play with when we were children, when we used to sit and listen to Father preach.
Yes, Dilys, I have a moustache.
He smiles gently and takes my hand in his. Brings it to his lips. In the gloom it looks so pale, like crisp white linen.
Listen, he says, looking up into my face. I need you to understand where we're... My God, Dilys, you're bleeding.
So I am, just like the day the branch cut his head. You still have the scar, Adrian. I reach out and touch the puckered line above his eye. There are tears on my fingertips. The blood has turned them pink. I remember the day Grace bathed my hand in the healing water. She took the bowl and made me clean. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow, I say.
Dilys?
But I don't have time to explain. We need to go.
Mother will come and get me, I say. She'll try to stop me.
No, Dilys, no one's coming. No one will stop us, not now.
He pulls me down next to him and wraps his arms around me.
They wouldn't dare.
I thought I was hearing voices, I whisper. I thought I was going mad, but all the time it was you. It was you, Adrian. You were trying to send word, weren't you?
Hush, dear girl, you're safe now. Everything will be all right. We're going to take you away from here. We'll look after you.
He means Grace. He means they'll look after me together. Where is she? I try to say it, but the thought of her makes my throat burn, makes my tears fall. Relief flooding out of me. It rises up in waves and my head feels as though it's expanding, as if I might float away, just like that first breath of Grace's cigarette, just like that night in the churchyard. Where's Grace? I say, pulling away from him. She's the one who helped you, isn't she?
Yes. She saw me watching the house and she came out, walked past me on the street, whispered there were things she had to tell me. We arranged to meet by the river. She told me what had been going on in there. What Mother did with Peter is disgusting.
He turns and looks out of the window.
She told me that woman, Mrs. Goodwin, had been hiding my letters, and she managed to get the doctor to see you, which is more than I could do alone. I'm so sorry, Dillis. She's been a better friend to you than I have been a brother. She obviously cares about you very much.
She loves me. That is our truth. I wonder if she told him that herself, or whether she chose to keep it secret. I wonder whether Adrian would understand.
Mother's religion has made you ill. Grace wants you to get better, we both do. Here,
he says, reaching inside his jacket pocket to pull out an envelope.
She asked me to give you this.
Inside is a note written in Grace's hand. Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth. Third Book of John, chapter 1, verse 2. And suddenly I am starting to unravel, moths gnawing through the threads of hope that have been holding me together. Where are we going, Adrian?
Far away from all this.
But Grace is coming with us, isn't she? He looks down at our hands again and squeezes his fingers around mine.
Dear girl, he says, all in good time.
The slam of the driver's door makes me jump.
We have to get you away from here first.
Adrian starts to speak, but his voice is lost as the engine starts up. It makes the van shake. Or perhaps I am the one shaking. Through the two small windows in the back, I watch Albany Road start to move. Terraced soldiers on parade, marching into the distance. We drive past the corner, past the street lamp. We've come more than 77 steps. Too far for her to get me now.
Deep breaths, Adrian says. Here, have a good old glug of this, it'll help to calm your nerves. I can't imagine what it must have been like in that house.
I take a sip and taste the bitter fire of alcohol.
A nip of brandy, he says. That's it, drink up. It'll do you good. Now rest your head on my shoulder, Dilly, and try and get some rest. We haven't got far to go now.
But we have. We have a long, long way to go. We're going all the way to India. I close my eyes and imagine we're already at sea. Imagine that every jolt and turn of the van is a wave buffeting a swaying ship. I imagine that it is lulling me to sleep. When I wake up, we'll be there. Grace will be waiting. Octavia's Diary, 1915. I followed a nurse through a very handsomely furnished corridor. I noticed that she locked and unlocked many doors, but I did not worry about this, as I thought I was being taken to the House of Rest. I suddenly, however, found myself in a corridor where obviously insane persons were wandering aimlessly about. One came up and made hideous snatchings at me. Others surrounded me with curiosity. I said to the nurse, "This is not the place I want to come to. This is a terrible mistake. I have not been sent here as a lunatic." She replied, "Oh, I have heard that kind of tale before," and remembrance of novels I had read rose up before me. A hard, cruel look came into her face, which warned me that it was wiser to conform amiably for the moment, lest I should be subjected to personal force. The door was open of a padded room in which, as far as I can remember, I saw a naked lunatic. I was put into a small bedroom next to it, with a window which would only open about 6 inches and had heavy wooden shutters. There came distressing sounds from a distance. At the end of the corridor was the nurse's mess room, where, at intervals, noisy meals were in progress. Just across the garden was the great kitchen where washing up for 500 patients was done. Everybody knows the power to irritate of the sound of washing up. Each door in the building had to be slammed shut to make it lock, and could only be opened by a noisy key. I ask, is not all this enough to make a perfectly sound person nervous? I ask again, is not all this enough to make a slightly nervous person insane? The Crossing. I haven't seen the sea, or the sky. There is no window. It must mean I am below the water level. But I'm safe here. I'm not drowning. Not anymore. The cut on my head is healing. A nurse washed away the blood when I arrived. Try not to touch it, she said rather officiously. But sometimes I knock the scab, and once I start picking, I can't seem to stop. Perhaps I'll have a scar like Adrian's. I have no mirror to check. The cabin is so sparse. In fact, there isn't much of anything, just a metal bed and a scratchy blanket. And I'm finding it hard to sleep at night. There's too much noise. The metal doors slam and locks turn. Trolleys rattle by, delivering meals further down the corridor, and sometimes I can hear screams. I imagine they must come from excited children playing hopscotch up on deck. There is so much humanity packed into a confined space. It makes me think of Edgar, who spent his last days at sea, trying to stay standing as the ground was moving beneath his feet. Sometimes the ship lists so violently that I struggle to get out of bed. Everything is always moving. Nothing is still. We set sail 3 days ago. I think it's three. I've lost track of the passing hours. I have no watch, no clock. The meals that arrive on trays are the only way to gauge the time of day. A surly woman passes them through a hatch in the door, like letters through a letterbox. I can only see her eyes. When will we be there? I ask. She doesn't answer. But I know it won't be long before we begin a new life in India. Adrian told me that when we arrived on board. I didn't wake until the back doors of the van creaked open, and even then I didn't want to move. I wanted to sleep. He helped me out and walked me up a flight of steps into the ship. Inside it looked just like a grand house. Waiters in white suits were waiting to greet me.
"They'll look after you, Dilys," Adrian said, giving one of them my arm. "You're safe now. Get better, and then we can start a new life together in India. I promise."
"You, me, and Grace," I said. He embraced me, and I felt as if he would never let me go.
"All this," he said, "it's not forever, and it's for the best. I had to get you away from her."
Then he turned away and left. He must have gone to his own cabin to make arrangements. We'll arrive just in time for the best weather. The monsoon season will have passed, and cloudless skies will give the sun free rein to shine. It will take me time to get used to the climate. Every day is hotter than a Bedford heat wave. That's what Adrian once said in one of his letters months ago. But I long to see the sun, to feel its warmth on my face, just like I did the day I met her. The day I went to the Bunyan Meeting Church. "Grace, do you remember?" I whisper. And she makes that noise, somewhere between a laugh and a sigh, somewhere between longing and contentment. She is standing behind me, resting her chin on my shoulder. I knew she would come. "And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." And now she is coming with me to the other side of it, to India. "I have something of yours," I say. "Something you lost." She can sew it on at last, onto her dark blue coat. I try to reach into my pocket, but I can't. And when I look down, I am wearing different clothes. clothes without pockets or buttons, clothes with buckles. I'm sorry, Grace, I can't find it. But she doesn't seem to mind. I feel her breath on my neck. Her hands move up to find me. Her fingers trace my collarbone across my shoulders down to my fingertips. And then she takes my hands in hers and draws me close, wraps my arms across my body tightly, too tightly so I can't move at all. She is holding me. I am being held. Appendix. Casebook, females 19. Number 7586. Name, Baltrop Mabel. June 24th, 1915. Cause, predisposing, blank. Exciting, change of life. Number of attacks, second. Duration, 3 months. Form of mental disorder, melancholia. Mabel Baltrop was in bed. Her eyes were suffused and bloodshot, the face bruised. She said that the condition of her eyes was caused in the effort to strangle herself and not by any direct injury. She felt all her nerves were springing. She then said that she had committed the unpardonable sin, which was preaching religion to people and not practicing it herself, and had better destroy herself. Is very nervous and somewhat hysterical, says she has lost all control of her nerves. States that she has got hold of an evil spirit, that all the powers of darkness are after her and fill her with terror. Makes constant restless movements, picking at the wall and drawing the bedclothes up and thrusting them down. She tells me that occasionally she is inclined to injure other people, and that she also has suicidal thoughts. A short time ago she did attempt to drown herself, but unfortunately she could swim. She says she feels sure she would kill her son, for whom she has a great affection, should he come to see her. Last night she became violent and attempted to strike the other patients. She requires constant supervision and has been moved to prevent her doing harm. Patient has been writing letters to the king. She apparently imagines she has had a special revelation from God telling her how the war was caused and the way to stop it. She is somewhat incoherent and strange in her conversation. She writes a considerable amount of nonsense. Her delusions are of such a nature that they warp her judgment of almost everything. She believes that she has been specially chosen by God to improve mankind, etc. She exhibits a most compelling ingenuity for catching up people when they converse with her.
Author's note. In the dining room of a Victorian house on Albany Road in Bedford, I sat and waited for an archivist to return with the first box file. On the walls, framed posters warned of crime and banditry, distress and perplexity. In a glass cabinet were leather-bound volumes of the nightly messages Octavia believed she had received from God. Inside that first file I found a jumble of sealed envelopes, each marked, "For the Divine Mother, if unopened, please burn." I took Octavia's paper knife and I opened them one by one, reading the confessions of members of the real Panacea Society. Just as their leader had commanded, every detail of life had been preserved, room upon room of brown parcels cataloguing every business and spiritual transaction. With the kind permission of the Panacea Charitable Trust, which maintains the archive, I was able to plunder its secrets over a number of months. Sections of the novel are quoted from source material, including letters, society instructions, and case notes relating to Mabel's psychiatric treatment. Among the many diaries and albums was a photograph of the Panacea ladies taking tea on the lawns of the Garden of Eden. While those around her chatted, a young woman was looking up, straight into the lens of the camera. It was a photograph of Dilys Baltrop, and already fascinated by the society, I became intrigued to uncover her story, and the rapture began to take shape. No offence is intended towards any living relatives of Panacea members. Though this is a work of fiction, the majority of the characters and their experiences are inspired by fact, though dates have been changed to condense the story into a year. In the case of Mabel's medical notes, I have combined two reports from two stays in different hospitals. My writing of Dillis, Octavia and Emily was informed by correspondence and diary entries. And details of Edgar and Donald's relationship were taken from confessions and letters. I know much less about the many members who lived in neighbouring streets, but have borrowed their names and circumstances to imagine the wider cast of characters. The only wholly invented person in the novel is Grace, who took up one of the positions of unpaid servant offered to those who didn't have the means to buy or rent a place in the garden. There's no evidence that Dillis had any romantic relationship with anyone in the society. Though other members confessed to attractions and intrigues, so here I intertwine their stories with hers, and in fiction, give her a love affair that reality may never have afforded her. The real Adrian Baltrop sent numerous letters to his mother, threatening legal action and accusing Emily Goodwin of keeping his correspondence from her. Research suggests he employed messengers to get help to his sister, who was eventually sent away to recuperate. But despite a period away from the society, the real Dillis chose to return and spent the rest of her life in Bedford. I owe many of the facts about the structure and theology of the Panacea Society to research carried out by priest and historian Jane Shaw for Octavia, Daughter of God, The Story of a Female Messiah and Her Followers, a non-fiction book written at the invitation of the last surviving members. Details of the opening of the other box were drawn from Exploding the Southcott Myth, Harry Price's own accounts in Leaves from a Psychist's Casebook. Parts of this story were written in the homes and gardens in which it is set, where I was able to handle the linen that Octavia had breathed on, climb into the clock tower, and sit and make notes in Dillis's bedroom. As the aging members of the Panacea Society began to die, their rooms were sealed up and their belongings kept just as they'd left them. Everything was made ready for the day they would return with Jesus by their side. Even after Octavia's death in 1934, the Panacea Society continued to attract new members. And by 1943, when Emily Goodwin died, there were 80 living in Bedford and nearly 2,000 worldwide. Conservative estimates suggest 130,000 applications were received for the healing water, and linen squares were still being posted to believers around the world until the death of the last member, Ruth Klein, in 2012. Today, Octavia's house and her Garden of Eden are open to the public. The Panacea Museum still keeps the secret of the location of the real box, believed to contain Joanna Southcott's prophecies. That box has yet to be opened.
You have been listening to The Rapture by Claire McGlasson, read by Imogen Wilde. Text copyright Claire McGlasson 2019. Production copyright Faber Audio 2019. The right of Claire McGlasson to be identified as author of this work has been asserted in accordance with the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. The producer was Alex Raymond at ID Audio London. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.